Thanks for tuning in. From Municipal World, I'm Susan Gardner. This is the MW Shares podcast, where we share your stories, providing insights into the challenges and opportunities facing local governments and communities just like yours. Thanks for joining us for another episode of MW Shares Municipal Pandemic Response. In past episodes, we've talked about how new online tools have become so vital to ensuring business continuity during the pandemic. While we know this is true, it's also true that rural and remote communities have experienced significant challenges during this time. Many simply and quite literally don't have the bandwidth to access and use these tools in a reliable way. That is, an essential public service has been highlighted for us like never before. And despite commitments for funding and action to effectively address this, we know some communities are struggling to get online. But there may be a way for rural communities to take the proverbial bull by the horns and create their own local solutions. And our next guest, Jesse Hirsch, is going to help us look at the possibilities. Jesse is a futurist speaker, a researcher, and an internet strategist, an experienced innovator and collaborator. His passion is educating people on the potential benefits and perils of technology. And today, he's on deck with us to talk about municipal broadband and COVID-19. Welcome, Jesse.
Thanks, Susan.
So before we get started, I want to talk about this. You and I have chatted a few times over the past couple of years. And the very first time we met, and people can still find this interview on our website, we talked about your prediction that the future is rural.
It was rather prescient on my part, I have to say.
It really was. As a futurist, it does seem you had a bit of a crystal ball. It seems like forever ago, but I had to look back today, and it was only in 2018. And you were heading for the hills at that time and leaving the city for country life. And of course, we've now seen a huge trend of people doing just that, looking for ways to get out of the city and setting their sights on smaller rural communities. Did you really anticipate that we'd see this future become rural so soon?
No, not at all. In fact, most of the predictions I make are a combination of research and intuition. And in that case, it was more intuition than research. It was really just translating the internet and saying that as more and more people, as their work, their learning, even their social interaction happens online, then geography can be reconfigured. It doesn't mean that geography is irrelevant, but it does mean that you have the privilege of living in a forest or living in a smaller community or, you know, being able to have that work-life balance that can be really difficult when you're either living in a city or having to commute for a couple of hours a day. And so it was really me thinking about quality of life. But of course, with the pandemic, that has paid off tremendously, because while we were all locked down, my life, quite frankly, didn't change much at all. And it was that sort of privilege. It was that ability both to be with nature and to be able to still keep doing my work and sort of be prepared for the disruption that the pandemic brought, that I think illustrated that notion of the future is rural, because it provides the flexibility, it provides the quality of life that I think a lot of people are searching for.
And we are, you know, seeing this now. People have had, a taste of this kind of freedom to work where, work where you live and live where you choose. So many people are thinking about this, moving out of the city, but they really do want to locate in communities that still have stable, reliable internet.
Well, and that's the key. And I think where we are seeing a bit of a scramble, certainly here in Ontario, but I think in communities across the country, of people who are trying to find that combination you describe, a friendly community, a human scale community, but that still has the kind of infrastructure, in particular the internet infrastructure, that they need to be able to still do their job to find economic opportunity. And I find it interesting which municipalities recognize that. Either ones who have that infrastructure and are promoting it as a way to distinguish themselves from other parts of the country, other parts of the continent, but also those who realize that it's a deficit, that because they lack that kind of infrastructure, it's something they really need to prioritize, both when it comes to serving existing members of their community, but also thinking about the future, both in terms of economic development, but also changing demographics, that many rural and remote communities have very aging demographics, and there's a need to both attract new young families and retain the young people who are growing up there, but have traditionally sort of sought the big city as a place for economic opportunity. But the internet counters that. The internet makes it easier for people to be able to stay at home and still be able to find work and even broaden their horizons in the virtual sense of being able to access all the world's knowledge at their fingertips.
So this was certainly true to a certain extent. We knew this when we first talked about this a couple of years ago. But how has the pandemic changed our relationship with the internet now?
Well, as you mentioned earlier, I think it's reinforced the centrality that it plays to our lives. And in particular, it's become a kind of social safety net that for many people, whether it was during the lockdown or even after, you know, the internet became the place in which you had your social interaction, in which your kids were receiving their education, and in which many people were either working or alternatively searching for work. And I think we sort of took for granted previously, many people thought of the internet as entertainment or an extra, but it turns out that it literally is part of the social fabric of our society, of how we live, of how we do things. And similarly for municipalities, it very much became a way in which you think of public service delivery, in which you think of communicating in the context of a pandemic, essential and crucial information, that it was one of the main means by which you connect with people, by which people ask you and interact and ask for more information. And I think that was also something that many governments didn't really think about or saw as something futuristic, but not relevant to the present. So it's almost as if there was a crash course in how to do digital government and how to do digital public service delivery. And I think finally, you know, the other thing you sort of alluded to is the digital divide. That the pandemic really reinforced that whether across Canada or even across North America, there's a huge contrast between, you know, the digital haves who have fiber optic connections and are, you know, the pandemic was not really much of a disruption at all, to everyone else who at worst may be stuck on satellite or other types of wireless connections that made it really difficult to cope. I mean, certainly many of the people I know, the struggle was you couldn't run two virtual meetings at the same time. That if, you know, during the day, if one parent had to do a video conference, that meant that the kids couldn't really connect to school. It meant that other people couldn't do their same activities. So I think this really reinforced both the nature of the digital divide, especially here in Canada, because of our sort of geographic expanse, but also the consequences moving forward, that if we sort of neglect or fail to address this, it's going to get far worse. Because of course, you know, the people who do have great internet access, the people in major urban centers, they're not going to wait for everyone else. They're already figuring out all sorts of new video conferencing applications, all sorts of new remote education and telehealth and telemedicine applications. But they're not thinking about, they don't have the experience of living rurally or a small community. So they don't realize that there's a huge portion of the population who just don't have the capacity to do those things. And so the danger is as it moves forward that the divide will become even larger and more severe, especially when you think about things like medicine and education and social services moving online. That, you know, for example, the federal government released a COVID app, a notification app that would warn you if you came into contact with someone else who had tested positive, but it only runs on the latest version of smartphones. So if you yourself can't afford or don't have the latest model, you're left out. And the danger, as a metaphor, is that could apply to everything. That if we neglect or fail to really help and bridge that digital divide, we really are going to bifurcate into a kind of two-tiered society.
And one of the challenges, of course, and we're going to talk about this more as we get into some of the solutions to this. One of the challenges is much of this is determined by places where it makes sense for large telecoms to install install broadband, and the economics of it often don't work in smaller rural remote communities. But we dial this down to kind of the micro level. Let's talk about your internet situation.
Well, I had a little bit of hope, but also a combination of just willpower, that I recognized that the cost of moving to a rural community is that I would be losing stable internet, that I would be taking a bit of a downgrade, but that as a combination of an entrepreneur and an activist, I was willing to do something about it. Unfortunately, it's taking a whole lot longer than I might have hoped, but I am presently in the process of bringing a fiber optic connection to my home. And at the same time, my neighbors, because I approached them and said, hey, look, I need fast internet. If I'm going to go through the process of doing this, do you want to share the cost? Do you want to, you know, come with me? Because you also face the same problem. And so they were all quite enthusiastic. So step one was just getting my neighbors on side. And step two was researching different options and finding different providers and different companies. And in essence, I'm basically having to do it myself. I mean, I'm one step short from creating a micro internet service provider that would only have 10 customers, i.e. my neighbors, only because that's what needed to be done. You know, thankfully, my municipality is really quite open to working with different companies. And I found a few who are interested in trying to serve rural customers. But what I found in doing my research is that it's often that. It's often individuals. It's often people who are so desperate that they, you know, kind of combine the activist with the entrepreneur and both lobby their municipal government and lobby companies and find experts who know how to do telecom, who know how to run fiber optic cable and just make it happen. So while on the one hand, I've been frustrated that I still am kind of stuck on a, you know, second class connection, I've learned a ton. And in so learning that, I think I've found different ways in which Canadian communities, because the challenge with Canada really is our geography, yes, that we have such a diverse geography, such a sprawling geography in terms of some municipalities, that's why it is, from a business perspective, really difficult, really challenging. And why many of the major providers just don't have the time. I mean, they're too busy trying to support more dense or urban environments. And that's partly why I've sort of discovered a bunch of companies that specialize in rural internet, that have figured out how to do it as cheap as possible, that have figured out different types of creative solutions. And it's easy to learn from them to figure out how it applies to your own community as a whole.
So what's been the overall focus of your research on this?
Well, I began by really looking at the community side of trying to understand how communities were doing as I was doing in terms of sort of taking the internet into their own hands and finding control. But even though I approached it with that agenda or with that bias, what I actually found out was the role of municipalities. That the communities who really figured it out, the ones that were really able to achieve not just quality internet, but affordable internet, it was when the municipality played an incredibly large role. That it's really not enough for the community to do it on its own. That when the municipality gets involved, I mean, that's when you really get the win-win of not just better internet, but, you know, better economic development, better social services. You're sort of, you know, lifting the tide that raises all boats, as the cliche may be. And there's quite a range of different solutions that municipalities have pursued. Some which are relatively hands-off, in which the municipality is really just sort of giving a helping hand and not being directly involved, to others in which the municipality runs the entire internet and owns the entire internet as revenue generation, in that one of the kind of not so, one of the open secrets of the telecom industry is that the internet service is very profitable. That, you know, the margin on providing internet service is incredibly high. And while the initial capital cost is quite expensive, the cost of running towers or running fiber optics, that, you know, that's a little cumbersome. but the return is almost immediate, and the revenue generation just on providing internet access has allowed a lot of municipalities to find a new source of revenue, which for many rural and small communities is crucial. But then, of course, there's the other side, which is the economic development, which you alluded to earlier, that when people start to recognize that a community has a kind of future-proof internet infrastructure in which you know that moving forward, they're going to have really fast and really reliable connections, that's when businesses start, you know, kicking the tires, start finding reasons to reconsider moving. And that's part of what's happening right now with, you know, the embrace of virtual work. You're seeing companies as big as Shopify, for example, which just announced they were closing their Ottawa headquarters because they want everyone to work from home. So it's an opportunity, I think, for smaller and especially rural communities to finally be able to compete with some of the major urban centers for business relocation, for professionals setting up in town, if they're able to demonstrate that they've got the type of high speed and reliable connectivity that many of the municipalities I've encountered have invested in and successfully deployed.
Now we're going to take a short break before getting into the rest of the conversation with Jesse Hirsch. Municipal World's Executive Membership delivers a powerful toolkit for managing Canada's towns and cities. You get the most complete suite of print and online news, plus high-impact communication services and exclusive member content, as well as information to help you and your community stay a step ahead. Executive membership is sized to fit your organization, from 5 to 50 users per membership, and members report saving an average of $1,287 per year just on job postings. It's a smart investment that can quickly pay for itself. Become a member today. Without further delay, let's jump back into that conversation with Jesse Hirsch. Now, it sounds like there's quite a range of options and examples for municipalities to choose from in all of this.
Well, there are. And I think it really depends both on the needs of that municipality, which are often geographical, or, you know, the stomach, the extent to which they really want to lead or champion these causes. And, you know, there's a bunch of different examples here in Canada, as well as the United States. I mean, one of the ones that I find sort of most inspiring is Caslow, BC. And this is in the East Kootenays. And Caslow is one of those situations where, due to the mountains, it just appears to outsiders as impossible. And that's why none of the major telecom providers were willing to go there. They were a town that literally had no internet. And so the town came together, initially led by citizens, but the town decided to take it on to build their own infrastructure. And what's interesting about Caslow, BC is they literally had to start from scratch, both in terms of learning how the internet works, recognizing what the capital cost outlay would be, how much it would cost for them to run fiber throughout the community. But they also had to use wireless because of the elevation changes, because they're literally on the side of a mountain. And so they were a great example in which they literally built it from scratch. And the benefit of which is they were able to keep the cost down, because locals tend to understand not only their own geography, but the ways in which they can cut corners, or the ways in which they can save costs by not having to go over the top, but get that bare minimum, get that minimal viable product. In contrast, say, to Olds, Alberta, and Olds, Alberta is one of the oldest municipal fiber internets in Canada, and that they started in 2011. And they sort of went, they looked at it from an economic development perspective, where Caslow was really about serving residents who were neglected. Olds, Alberta had relatively decent internet, but they had a history of cooperatives, partly from the agricultural sector, and recognized that if they created an internet infrastructure, that it would encourage industry, that it would encourage companies, that it would sort of encourage, whether in an industrial park or a commercial zone, the ability for companies to be more competitive. And so it really ranges in terms of the different sort of business model that these municipalities take. But on the other hand, an American example, which I thought was quite interesting, was Ammon, Idaho. And in Ammon, Idaho, they did the same thing as Olds, Alberta, where they invested in creating their own infrastructure throughout the municipality. But then they just, rather than provide that internet access directly to consumers, they allowed companies to do on top of it. So think of it in the same sense of sort of a P3, a public-private partnership, in which the municipal infrastructure spends the money to create the fiber optic network around the town, but then any company can sell services on top of that. The same way, for example, that you pay for your internet access and then you pay a bit more for Netflix, who delivers those services on top of that infrastructure. And I'm getting a little technical, but the short of it is that in Ammon, Idaho, you can get fast internet access, like gigabit per second, as fast as currently available, for $10 a month. And they're able to do it so cheaply because the infrastructure is public, but then the actual competition for services is anyone can come in and say, well, we're going to provide a better service or we're going to provide a cheaper service. So it's an interesting example in which you have the municipality acting as a kind of monopoly that then allows private companies to compete, that then creates radically low prices. And there are many other examples, but it really reflects both a desire to customize to the sort of needs of the locality while experimenting with different business models and experimenting with different configurations on how that access is actually delivered.
So it really, in many ways, allows the community to take charge of the process, address issues around the digital divide and other things, you know, as you said, that would be community priorities around economic development and supporting businesses and so on. And wow, $10 a month for high-speed internet, man, that is the dream.
Well, and it speaks to what's possible via municipal internet, because the two things, the two primary things that a municipality can bring is one, scale, right? Just being able to essentially unite the municipality together, even if it's a tiny municipality, makes a huge difference. Because part of the reason that, you know, existing telecom operators are the most profitable companies in the world is because it's a little bit of divide and conquer. Right? They're literally taking each individual and asking them to pay a whole lot of money, when if you spread the cost amongst everyone who lives in the municipality, it's radically cheaper. But then the other is the policy leadership and the expertise, that when you have the municipality say, you know, this is a real challenge for our community. We're going to learn this stuff. We're going to figure out how we can address these issues. All of a sudden, you're kind of raising the literacy of the community as a whole, and you start recognizing both the way in which the cost of internet services can fall radically, but also the kinds of things you can do with it expand dramatically. Because in the municipal context, we're talking about smart city technology and Internet of Things and more responsive infrastructure. And that's why it's not just remote or rural communities. I mean, two other examples: York Region in Ontario and Coquitlam in British Columbia are both examples of municipalities or regional municipalities that are relatively dense and somewhat urban, but they actually invested in their own fiber infrastructure to lower the cost for the municipality. That the municipality found that their telecom costs were so high because they're paying, you know, the external provider so much money, that they calculated that if they ran their own fiber and didn't even necessarily make it available to residents or companies, but just used it primarily for municipal infrastructure, that the cost savings were tremendous. But in both cases, they also realized, hey, if we make this available to local industry, if we start making this available to local residents, we're not only lowering their internet costs, but we're giving them more reason to engage and interact with the municipality as a whole. So it's not always about bridging the digital divide. Sometimes it's just about more efficient municipal services at a lower cost, but really comes down to those issues of scale and leadership, that when you think of the municipality at its scale and you invest in the kind of knowledge and leadership within the municipal structure, it has tremendous payoff, both for the municipal government, but also for its residents.
And when you say this, obviously, you know, we've seen now that, you know, high-speed internet is definitely something everyone wants. And if you're a community that, you know, has a serious attraction and retention policy priority, this would be a great way to differentiate yourself, to be able to offer this and offer it at a reasonable cost to residents and businesses.
Well, that's just it. And it partly gets into the kind of myth that internet has to be expensive when it doesn't at all. But I think that competitive advantage you mentioned is key. I mean, another great example from the United States is Chattanooga, Tennessee. And Chattanooga, Tennessee, while not a small municipality, is certainly outshone by neighbors like Memphis or Nashville just in Tennessee itself, let alone other major urban centers in the U.S. Southeast. But they've actually renamed themselves Gig City, not so much for musical gigs, but for gigabit internet. Because what's interesting about Chattanooga, Tennessee, is that they already had a municipal utility. So this is sort of comparable to Thunder Bay or Sudbury, in that both Thunder Bay and Sudbury have municipal telecom providers, Thunder Bay Telephone up in Thunder Bay. That means that the municipality already has some telecom expertise. You know, they already have linemen, they already have the sort of network infrastructure to begin with. And Chattanooga, they saw this as a huge economic development opportunity. That both in running fiber optic infrastructure throughout the entire municipality, and then in branding the municipality as Gig City to sort of showcase that they had this really high-speed internet, it was a really effective branding and marketing campaign that has translated into Chattanooga becoming actually a major tech center in the United States, even though they still tragically kind of fly below the radar. And it is because of the way in which they've synonymized themselves with high-speed internet as a strategic plan that has not only elevated the tax base in terms of attracting new residents and attracting new companies, but it helps them weather the storm when you think about things like the pandemic, where you know, they were already ready. They already had the infrastructure. As a municipality, they already understood digital public service delivery. So it's not just about internet access. It's really about thinking about capabilities as a municipality as a whole. And by emphasizing on that economic development, you also get the byproduct of sort of upgrading the municipal literacy when it comes to using that sort of infrastructure.
If your community is struggling with the broadband issue, you may be interested in an upcoming masterclass we're hosting with Jesse. Jesse will show you how to create and implement your own community broadband strategy. If you're interested in getting information about that masterclass as soon as it's open, please send us an email at internet@municipalworld.com with your name, email, and phone number, and we'll put you first on our list to notify when that registration opens. I want to thank Jesse for taking the time to chat with us, and thank you for listening. Stay tuned for part two, where Jesse shares his thoughts on the need for internet preparedness, the challenges that rural areas face with connectivity, and what the future holds for municipal broadband. If you'd like to hear more from Jesse, follow him on Twitter at Jesse Hirsch. If you found the information in today's episode useful, we hope you'll please drop us a note to let us know, or give us a shout on Twitter at Municipal World. Until next time, I'm Susan Gardner. This is MW Shares. Please stay healthy, stay safe.